again, yet again, to another episode of Systemic. Again, we're here with Farabala today, who is from Farsight and is going to be talking with us about the ideas of belonging and inclusion, some of the work that she's doing there. So, Farah, thank you so much for your time here today. Thank you.
Dan, thank you so much for having me. I am so excited to have this conversation with you.
I want to jump right in. In doing some research and looking into sort of the work that you've been doing, there's a lot of talk around the idea of belonging and inclusion. Can you speak a little bit to why those two areas, you know, we're talking about DEI or IDEA or whatever, you know, acronym someone's using at the moment, why inclusion and belonging are the two that really stick out to you?
I have a intersectional identity background. My ancestry is Persian. I grew up in Bombay, India, also called Mumbai now. And I have been in the United States for over 20 years. I grew up in a community that is considered a minority community, even in India, believe it or not. So my community is called Zoroastrianism. The faith is Zoroastrianism. The community is Zoroastrians. And then there are the Iranian Zoroastrians who stayed in Iran at the time, Persia. And then the Parsi Zoroastrians who fled and moved and got themselves to the western shores of India. The story goes, and this is centuries ago, that this boatload full of exiles reached the shores of Gujarat, which is a state in India. And their king, and you know, they were looking for refuge. And the king at the time, Jadav Rana, sent over a bowl of milk, a bowl of milk filled to the brim, not space for one extra drop. And the message was that we are at capacity. We have no space. And so the exiles, my ancestors, the story goes, asked for a bowl of sugar. And they took the sugar, added it to the milk, stirred it in, and sent it back to the king. The message being that we will strive to merge ourselves within your community, sweeten it as we go along, and will not unsettle it, and will not increase or decrease the level of who you are currently. And the king was really impressed. I haven't done the scholarly research. But I love the story so much. I think it is a testament to what it means to include and what it means to create belonging. And if you asked me this, you know, over two decades ago, of course I would not have this analysis. But doing the work that I currently do, even when I started conceiving Farsight and what I wanted it to be, I just kept coming back to the story. Mm-hmm. This is also a story that I think my life has emulated in many, many ways. Coming in with all of the complexities of what it is being a teenager and then finding the world of theater. Mm-hmm. And theater is a space that transcends borders, that transcends language and culture. It is truly a space where everybody is welcome, not just as an audience, but as a practitioner. And the theater, I always say I'm a product of arts education. The theater is where I found my voice. I found confidence. I found expression. And I, you know, I feel very lucky that I moved to the States to pursue a master's in theater. And, you know, at the time, the goal was just performing, acting. But I had always, you know, even when I was in Mumbai, I was teaching theater. And then there were opportunities here in arts programs, being a teaching artist in the public school system. And watching firsthand the power of social emotional learning, the power of using tools of theater and improvisation in learning environments to foster community, deepen dialogue, engage in highly polarized topics, but in a way where everyone had a voice, where there's no cancel culture in the theater, which is a beautiful thing. So I come to this work through many, many spaces. And then my lived experience, been here as long as I have. I have what I call my 7.5 to 8 year immigration journey, where I've been through every immigration status in the United States from student to citizen. And that is an experience, an education in itself, how from student you get to be alien, then you get to be permanent resident, and then you get to be citizen. Literally having moved through absolutely no privilege as a student, right? It's like at the lowest rung of any kind of access as soon as you leave university. Within university, you're fine. The last thing I'll say is, in my first 3 months in grad school, a very well-meaning administrator in my theater department, and she said to me, Farah, you know, you're going to be working twice as hard as almost everyone in your class. Because here you are in the minority. You are a person of color and you're a woman. That was the moment race was ascribed to me. In the casting world, you don't look Indian enough. You don't sound Indian enough. You know, the features have to be a specific way. And so that started me interrogating, all right, I am Indian, but yes, I have this community that I come from. So maybe I need to hyphenate. So then trying on Persian Indian. Then suddenly other roles opening up or opportunities of roles opening up. And it was just fascinating, just my own, you know, pursuing a career, but then all of this data, perception of identity that I learned, observed. And then in turn, you know, there was a form of resistance initially because I'm Indian, you know. But then, yeah, if you're going to live someplace, there's a co-creation, right?
Yeah,
of what does that involve to really embrace that full identity? Because in India, saying I'm Indian, people will know still.
Right.
But over here, you need to make that more explicit.
In that moment, race was ascribed to you. And it's a weird notion, but you're right, because I think that most, at least in the United States, I think most persons of color can go back to that moment where you were growing up and all of a sudden you realized, oh, I'm the history lesson we're learning about in class today. You know, I'm the different one. For me, I remember I was a young child coming home one day and telling my mother that this a friend of mine had called me the N-word, and not understanding what the word meant, but seeing my mother's face immediately change and the seriousness in her tone of, no, that's not accurate. And you know, belittling, but coming after me to figure out who said this and why they said it and what was the situation so she could go and rectify it. And in hindsight, yeah, like that was the moment race was ascribed to me, because before then, like, that was just my friend. I had no clue that there was a difference. And then in that moment, someone points it out and it's like, oh, and now there's this new lens in which you sort of start viewing the world, but almost also the new lens in which you realize this is how the world views me. You know, that this is the box that I've been put in without even knowing it, you know? And so how, talk about that leap then. So you come from this background of theater and stage where there's this inclusion and acceptance where authenticity of who you are is what's expected on a day-to-day life. And now you're working in a field where you're trying to tease this out of people on a regular basis. How does that leap go from, you know, you navigating this world where you, in those steps that you went from student to citizen and all of these things that you're living through, why make this your career? Why leave art and sort of go, why take on this of all things?
I attribute this to a couple of things, lived experience. So as much as I am gushing about the essence of theater, right, and pedagogy and the practice of theater, the theater industry in itself in the United States is going through a moment. There was a time of my life of, as everyone goes through, right, you are trying to make it in quotes, whatever that means. And for me at the time, was specifically acting. And because of my immigration journey, I had to be, even my day jobs or side jobs had to be within my field. And so, you know, art education, teaching artist work, which just came naturally to me. And then I got introduced to similar work around the umbrella of communication training for corporate environments and professional services environments. And I was just fascinated. You know, so there are various tools of theater and improvisation and techniques that are used in learning environments. And so I was just, you know, working in those ways, an odd job here and there. But I did it, you know, there was a time when I did it consistently enough and I understood what was happening in the room. And it just fascinated me. I'm like, oh my goodness, these people, you know, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Citibank, like you name all of these high flying finance places, law firms, and the way these programs are designed to help them, to train them. And like 2 hours later, 3 hours later, it's like, wow, they got so much out of this. They are not better than me. They are also human. They also have their needs and growth opportunities. And this was helpful. And then what we were saying through why communicate in a certain way, right? Why support, give feedback in a productive way. And that just did something for me. And so I geeked out. I wanted to do more in that space. Yeah. And so I, going back to the why of the career change, I think I have an insatiable curiosity. As soon as I see something that sparks something in me, I'm going after it. So I started my own education in psychology, positive psychology, specifically brain science, you know, getting certified as a coach. I was at, you know, moving through the career of acting. There was a moment in time where I got let go. It was at the time a highly volatile situation. Why was I let go? Of course, they didn't say that. It was said, this is not a good fit. But I was the one speaking up for things that I was seeing. Call them inequities, call them things that were not happening per union protocol, etc. And I just found myself, I don't know anything else. I see something, I say something. That was a pivotal moment for me after the rage, the wave of rage passed, that, oh, there is a voice here, you know. Simultaneously, parallel to that, I started leading, co-leading a theater company, producing work for the South Asian community, and got a first row seat into leadership. What it means to be a leader and what is missing in leadership. And I was around toxic environments. And I was like, no one's focused on moving this forward. There is so much self-interest. There is so much insecurity. There is so much lack of knowledge. And within these bubbles, decisions are being made. So of course, those decisions are going to cause exclusion. Of course, those decisions are going to be problematic. Because the core from where the decisions have been made are not as intentional as they could be. So all of this is happening simultaneously. In another part of my world, two or three times where someone was like, Farah, you should be a coach. You're a great listener. You should be a coach. And I would laugh. I was like, absolutely not. And then I was in this moment I am not happy. That none of this is fulfilling. I'm trying to do something here, but I'm just not gaining traction. And I was like, I need to explore what this coaching thing is. And Dan, I kid you not, as soon as I verbalized it, within the week, I had been introduced to two executive coaches and I knew nothing about coaching. I'd been introduced to two executive coaches, one of whom introduced me to their dear friend who was in a coaching program, who had, you know, so she was fresh from all of the research she had done less than a year ago. Mm-hmm. And within a week, I had all of the information I needed, including a short list of coaching programs. You know, and sometimes when the universe has something planned for you, it has something planned for you.
Right.
It felt so effortless. And I was like, I will be an idiot if I don't follow through on this. And so a lot of synchronicities, a lot of lived experience, a lot of curiosity and then dissatisfaction and seeing, right? And then that phase over a decade ago is when my investment in leadership, where I want to work.
Gotcha.
Now, while all of this is happening, I am then, you know, part of these unconscious bias programs, like unconscious bias training. And this is part of the DEI work. So anytime anyone talks about, oh, we are a DEI firm, what do? We do unconscious bias trainings. I did those for years. learned a lot, learned about my biases and, you know, learned a lot. It's an essential training process to go through. Mm-hmm. But it's not the only one to go through.
As everyone's slowly realizing.
So every time I would ask, okay, what's coming out of this? Like, how are y'all measuring impact of this workshop? Attendance, right? So that's how we're measuring impact. Like, we got so much attendance. Yeah, but mm-hmm. how is it shifting culture? How is this shifting
right. How
people are holding themselves accountable? None of that mm-hmm. was happening because why? It's a compliance thing. You check the box. And exactly. So then I started gathering that lived experience of, okay, I'm doing the work. It's good work. And then, you know, so as a freelance coach consultant, I'm doing like these separate things. There is coaching. There is leadership programs with no mention of anything around equity, inclusion, belonging, diversity. Mm-hmm. And then I'm doing DEI work, which is primarily unconscious bias. And so, you know, the conscience, the authenticity started rubbing. Because in my brain, what's happening is, no, they don't sit separate. They are all connected and they're woven together. And right. that is why we're still doing this work. That is why it is a multi-billion dollar industry with not enough momentum, at least as I would like, because right. we are not seeing this together. One is very systemically, historically placed, untouched. And then the mm-hmm. other is, you know, it's like a little hamster trying to catch up. And so I had to have my own moment of, I can either complain and be disgruntled or, you know, do something. I think it's just showing up to myself, listening to what the need is, satiating curiosity. And I clearly like to challenge myself. Farsight was born on the backs of all of this. And I call gotcha. This my, you know, global experiment. Is this possible? Can we move minds and systems to see them together? I know I've said this in other spaces, but my understanding is the reason we are here still doing this work, still trying to move along, is when an organization is built, there is conceiving the business, mission, value, strategy, budget, leadership, board, all of that gets built. What is our, you know, strategies at every level, 3 to 5 year strategy, all of that gets built and you're chugging along. And then some voice will say, oh, what about DEI? Oh yeah, let's do DEI as well. So you have this thing that has foundationally been set up and then you slap on DEI, EDIA, mm-hmm. you know, all of the acronyms as a Band-Aid. And there is adhesive on that Band-Aid, and that adhesive in time is going to wear out. And here we are chugging along with our organization because we're not getting affected because we've not really embedded any of this.
Right.
And then a 2020 will come along with multiple Band-Aids, COVID, take care of your people, BLM, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, take care of your Black people, anti-Asian hate, take care of your mm-hmm. Asian folk, right? So now we had like a sticky adhesive. And what are we hearing now? I just got off a call yesterday with a potential client who's like, we had all of this investment and now people are like, can we just get back to normal? So what is normal? And we pledged and we made statements and we had mm-hmm. the black squares on Instagram. We were like, we are never going back.
And no, and I thank you. I thank you for all of that because it leads perfectly into my next question in understanding sort of where Farsight comes from, and that your real focus is on the idea of changing leadership as a means of changing culture. And I want to go into that notion because often I feel when we think about workplace culture and workplace leadership and all these things, the culture is almost an afterthought, right? Like you said, you build all these things, you get it ready to go. And after 5 years, you know, it's like, all right, so who are we as a company? And that's where, you know, culture tends to come from. It's like, after we've hired all the people, mm-hmm. they will define our culture. And this is the culture. Now we go that forward, but it's almost backwards because it's, if you haven't been intentional about what you want your culture to look like, you're always going to be sort of be playing catch up and trying to correct. So is it, we need to start with leaders and making sure that they get inclusivity from day one or whenever we start this process so that it's not always catch up. Like why leadership, and then how do we make sure that they really do buy in?
Because leadership are the gatekeepers of power. and systems and structures and policies and procedure within an organization. And so for us, it's saying we are, so Farsight, we, you know, in my introduction, I'll always say we are leadership organizational development with a prioritization of concepts and practices of EDIA. And we use EDIA, equity, diversity, inclusion, anti-oppression, as a core competency of leadership. Because that has, we have other core competencies of leadership. In your 360, when you go through the core competencies, it's only recently that inclusion is part of it. So that's number one. Climate around where decisions are made, for who decisions are made, is crucial. And if you are sitting a small group of executive C-suites saying, here's what we want to give our people, here's what our people need, and you don't check in with them, you don't assess them, you don't ask them, you are literally making decisions based on your perspective, rightly or wrongly, and you have no idea how that's going to impact them. And when it doesn't impact them the way you want it to, it's not, it, your decision-making process doesn't get interrogated as much. It's about, oh, something went wrong there. I do a talk on power, gatekeeping, and accountability, specifically for executive leaders. This is where we start. You have to understand the various faces of power, the power that you hold as a leader, that you are by default speaking on behalf of your people, making rules, making your compensation packages on behalf of your people at all times. That is a massive responsibility. And how are you holding yourself accountable to making sure that you are doing it equitably? How are you holding yourself responsible to ensuring that this great recruitment strategy that you have is going to result in retention in a way that make people feel included, not in the way you think they should feel included, but in the way they want to feel included? So for me, it starts and ends with the person at the top. And then there is the whole other middle manager section as well, right? But there is so much data out there that the middle managers are the problem when it comes to like building inclusion, et cetera. Yes, and it has been created and perpetuated with the messaging that's coming from the top.
Right.
And so for me, and we are, again, here because systems have not shifted.
Yes.
Right? If you keep doing your unconscious bias trainings to check your box and measure it based on attendance, that you are doing it at the comfort of your people, and predominantly I'm going to assume white men who are in leadership positions. Another example of what that looked like in the recent past was with the onslaught of creating CDO positions, chief diversity officer. Suddenly all the black and brown people became chief diversity officers, certain white people too, which that is a, I have so many questions around that. All of this social, political, cultural momentum, and people had time. No one was working in 2020. So the voices were louder, people were listening better. And that's why we had more action. We have moved the needle. I don't mean to sound, like doom and gloom. We have moved the needle and we can get there in the conversation. However, those positions were created, majority with a lack of role clarification and a lack of seat at the table.
Right. Agreed.
With no access to power and decision-making. You have your CDO working hard, making recommendations, getting responded to. We have heard you. Thank you. Thank you for your recommendation. We have heard you. And nothing changes. We do organizational assessments, and we're currently in the middle of a couple of them. And part of our process is doing one-on-one interviews with a slice of the organization. So we were talking with, someone, and this was this week. And one of our, we asked, like, what is a recommendation you have to move the needle so that your company can actually walk its mission and value system that it has on the website? And number one recommendation, make your director of diversity an executive leadership position. And then start listening to this person and then start making change. So this is what I mean. Leadership making decisions in silos.
Right.
Based on tons of assumptions and biases and relationship to power. And there's a lot there to unpack. And so for me, my commitment is I want to spend my time there. Let's build more socially conscious leaders. Let's build more aware leaders. Let's build that tribe. And we've come a long way, right? There is a ton more advocacy and leadership. And we need more.
If leadership is where we're starting instead of, you know, looking elsewhere, because I think often we hear, you know, of grassroots DEI efforts is what people hear, and they tend to think it's starting from the bottom up. It's the idea that it's the workers, it's those who are impacted by the decisions. If they don't speak up, clearly there's no problem because they didn't speak up, which we know that that's not the means of speaking up, and the ability and the availability and the access and all those things often are taken away. But what do we say to leaders who aren't hearing the complaints, who don't think that there's an issue, not realizing that they are probably the actual issue? Like, what are we saying to them? How do we get leadership to at least acknowledge there's a problem that they can't even see?
Opaqueness of how data is gathered. And so if you are an organization of 10,000 people, and you are talking to a tiny group of 50 to 100 people and making your decision based on that, and then saying, I've talked to a lot of people and I've made my decision, that is a problem. Because I am now curious about how did you find those 100 people? What was their dimensions of diversity in terms of identities, race, gender, sexual orientation, a gender expression, title? Like, was it truly a cross-section of the entire organization? Or did you just go to people you know? Two, the other part of this is, who is the feedback giver, right? So a lot of the times what tends to happen is messages get muddled. So you tell me your experience, like let's say you and I are on the same team, you tell me your experience of something that happened. And here I am listening to a Black person telling me this. And if I then go and tell my leader, the team's morale is low and they're complaining a lot, I have completely mismanaged my job of passing on the message. Why? Why is that? As if I am the leader, right, in this dynamic between you and me, I have no lens. I do not have a lens of EDIA. So all and my own biases that we all know around anti-Blackness mm-hmm. are likely getting in the way. This is a hypothetical situation, folk, for anyone who's listening.
Right.
My biases are getting in the way, and I am now letting my biases speak. Mm-hmm. And convey a message that is completely inaccurate right. of what you came to me for.
And so what other roadblocks like that are you seeing? Like, because I think that probably happens more often than not, right? Like, somebody at the bottom is complaining or talking with an upper level, a mid-manager, and the message, because of lack of cultural competency or whatever exists there, mm-hmm. that message gets deterred, it's turned around into something else, so that even if the CEO or the CDO or whoever wants to take action, the action they're taking is probably misguided because the message is messed up. And so, like, that's one example. But what other roadblocks are there existing where leadership just isn't getting the message, or and going with the idea, you know, leadership wants to get the message. Let's make the assumption that they want their companies to work better. So, but they're not getting it, or they're missing the boat. What other roadblocks are there? What other things should people be looking for as, oh, this is a red flag with our leadership team, not with our employees?
So in our focus of leadership, every single person needs to have an EDIA lens to this work. So that if I am speaking to an entire team and I am talking about a conflicting conversation or feedback conversation, my preparation and giving someone feedback who identifies as a Black woman is going to be nuanced and complex mm-hmm. and different from giving feedback to, let's say, an Asian person, a white person, right? Every identity has its nuance based right. on the history of that community and the history of oppression. The other piece to this is process. We always say, and this is where every single person Another statement I tend to make a lot is every single person in an organization is responsible to create and transform culture. What does that mean? It's in the micro moments of how we are with each other, who we say hello to, who we ignore, who we celebrate, who we amplify, whose work we put down. Those are moments that create inclusion and belonging or disrupt it. Now, where does leadership come in? What kind of learning and development opportunities are you giving your people? Not just an unconscious bias training and staying with that, but what else do they need? Work around inclusive communication, working with a coach and having developmental opportunities, doing a feedback loop. Oh my God, that's the other piece. This is all part of what we're talking about. Higher umbrella theme is this is what we call the feedback loop. Right. Hear from your people, make certain commitments, changes, share them back with your people, let it sit for a bit, hear back from them, right? Mm-hmm. It's a cycle. Mm-hmm. This work is a cycle. Right. There is no destination. There is no red ribbon at the end of it. our work as practitioners is also shifting and changing. What I am saying today might be completely irrelevant in 5 years. I wouldn't be surprised by that. Maybe even potentially offensive with the way our, you know, cultural conversations are going. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we have to be okay with that. In the height of the pandemic, we had a client who we'd been working with. And I started getting curious about, you know, how are your people doing? And they were like, oh, yeah, we have an employee engagement assessment. You know, we have great results, with fantastic results. I was like, great, can I see that data just to understand what are you hearing and seeing? And that entire survey had no dimensions of diversity. It was not assessing for equity. It was not assessing for inclusion. It was truly employee engagement. How happy are you? How fulfilled are you?
Right.
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 This is what I mean by process. And it took a bit to, you know, to influence and say, like, this is what you need. This is actually not helping you because you are getting information that you want to hear. So right, again, you're in a bubble. And so when you hear the polar opposite from someone, of course, it's going to have a reaction from you because you have data. You have data that's saying everyone is really happy. Who have you heard from? What were their identities? Right? Yeah. Who took the survey? If only your white folk took the survey and no people of color took the survey, how are you measuring that? What does that say about your survey? What does that say about your people? Data tells a story. So how you collect your data has to be deeply intentional, deeply, deeply intentional. Focus groups, doing an organization-wide assessment, doing an externally conducted one, right? Mm-hmm. We do a lot of work where we come in, start a process for an organization, do it for a few years, and then once trust has built, then we kind of hand off to the organization and say, okay, you now have the capability of doing this by yourself.
Right.
Even internal processes, how are you communicating? What is the level of transparency or opaqueness to the process? Mm-hmm. Do people know what you're going to do with that data? Do people know how you came to this assessment? There's no need, right? So a lot of like, oh, they don't need to do that. Oh, we don't need to share that. Like those are that's where I want to get into and be like, why?
Yeah, why don't you feel the need to share
that? Why don't they need to know that? Why do you want to communicate that, right? So much context. And that is a form of holding power and gatekeeping.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It could be completely unintentional, but what is the impact it's having? You are completely excluding or negating someone else's experience. So coming back to your question, what are the roadblocks? Resistance to change, resistance to wanting to do things differently, fear of what you might hear back. I'll give you another example. I'm working with a client. We work across industry, so this is a smaller nonprofit. They have their patrons, and so we've created a process where they create a feedback loop with whoever works with them. And they are in such nascent stages with their relationship to feedback, right? And so a lot of the work that I'm doing is prepping them to, okay, you got a pocket of patrons responding in your first half of the year. That is just a tiny blip in your entire story. Learn from it. You don't go looking for, oh, good, this is what we did well. Oh, crap, we got a ding here. No, feedback is to be learned from. Let's learn where we can do better and then make some change. See how that goes, assess again, see how that goes. But it's, you know, right now what we're working with is a lot of resistance to, oh, we don't want to ask that question because we don't know what we're going to get back. That is why we want to ask.
That's why you need to ask the question.
Ask questions, right? And be okay with whatever you get. And don't hone in on, but that person said that. Why did they say that? And who are they? No, no, no. What is the theme here? What is the story here? Right?
Yeah.
What are you learning? It's like looking in the mirror. Assessing, asking your people is looking in the mirror. That's really polished.
I'm wondering if that's, and it's interesting that that is the, you know, one of the big roadblocks that comes to mind is the idea that it's the fear of we are doing it wrong and we don't want to know, you know, like we just put our head in the sand and if we don't pay attention to it, we won't find out.
Conversely, it's like everything's going fine, right? And then we have to, we can't talk about this work without talking about how the foundation of business, which is in a capitalistic society and business model, right? So it is all about profit.
Yeah.
It is all about the money and revenue generating spaces, right? And so a lot of this work, if you zoom out even more, is saying your people are helping you get there, but you just haven't thought of it that way. That's why it's called people leadership, shared leadership, like all collective leadership, all of these terms that have been out there, thought leadership in this last decade. Why are we saying that? It's saying you focused way too hard on only what generates revenue, but you have to pull back the curtain. Acknowledge, affirm, develop, appreciate your people who will get you even further on, right? So coming back to, it's not just we don't want to see what's wrong. I think things are going fine. We have our bottom line.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So why muddy the waters?
Right. For the metric that they actually care about, they are doing fine. It's getting people to realize that there are other metrics, specifically the humans in your organization that you need to be more worried about sometimes.
Exactly. And what is that a testament to? The value and the mission for equity and diversity is only on the website, but it is not a practice. So again, coming back to why building the tribe of socially conscious leaders is so important, that you are thinking about the duality all the time.
Which we did in 2020.
We were really pushed to do it. So we have that capacity to do it. And guess what? We survived. So many industries survived. So many didn't. My God, so many didn't. But so many did. And why did they? Because they reinvested in their people. They took care of their people.
So then going off of that, where are you seeing progress? Where, in leaning into Farsight and sort of the work that you're doing, in acknowledging that there's no magic bullet or magic pill and that there's no one's going to get it right and they're done with DEI. It's a continual process. But where are you seeing progress? Where's their growth? Where's the hope that, you know, this is actually working in some small way?
Let me just say this. We have a lot more allies than we did. We have a lot more voices than we did before. And we do have spaces where we have diverse leadership, not everywhere.
Yeah.
Nowhere close to. It's probably in the single digits of percentage, but we do. Do you remember earlier this year when all of these articles came out around, CDOs stepping down, chief diversity officers stepping down? Wall Street Journal, I think, had an article one specifically, like five people sent it to me. They're experiencing burnout and, we are over the hill with DEI, and then we have to, there are other priorities. There's a lot of fear. Like I started hearing from my community of practitioners of like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And it's real, right? Like I am in a liberal bubble here in New York City. This is where I practice from. But folk in other states where state laws are literally attacking their residents' identities, it is a very scary time. I do feel that where we have moved the needle is, and again, this is a gross generalization, but we are no longer having to make the case for diversity. Don't get me started on the how of the process and all of that. There are problems there, but we've moved the needle in spaces where the conversations aren't stopping. We've moved the needle in spaces where I have spoken with heads of HR, folk in the C-suite to say, we are not stopping our conversations. We are not stopping our initiatives. Yes, all of this is going on, but we can't do without it because it's now baked in. And that is the work. Once it's baked in, it's not going anywhere. So the folk who have consistently made this their commitment, made having an EDIA lens crucial to their job description, to their job success, to their performance reviews, to their compensation, or some percentage of it within their organization, they're going to be fine.
Yeah.
They're going to, you know, continue doing the work. When I say fine, I don't mean like they have solved the problem. No, we have never been where we are trying to get to. We have never been before, right? We have been, that's the work. It's an aspirational space. And the other piece to think about also, it looks different in different organizations, right? So when we talk about EDIA, all efforts around EDIA are just focused on racial diversity at your organization. For me, we might be doing okay. We might still have predominantly white leadership, but generally our racial diversity, not bad. Where we're lacking, LGBTQ plus work, our gender education. My organization might still have tons of resistance with pronouns. So that is our work. So it looks different in different organizations. Every single dimension of diversity has strains of inclusion that need to be addressed. A lot of work we do is inclusion and belonging is in the micro moments of how we treat each other, right? And that transcends the dimensions of diversity. And so once you have those set in, how you talk to each other, how you treat each other, levels of transparency, again, if those processes have been baked in, you're further along. I think we have a lot more concrete strategies than we did before. I think there is progress with the whether it's director of diversity or CDO, whatever the term is, having a seat at the table within human resources. There is still work to be done towards like creating a solid partnership between HR and EDIA. Within the communities that I touch, I don't think there is any space where it's like, ooh, it's a taboo to talk about XYZ. Even the current Middle East conflict that's happening, you know, Israel and Palestine, I have had people leaning in and asking me, hey, I know something needs to be done right now, but there is so much polarization happening. I just need to talk this through. And so there's a leaning in.
You know, and that's really interesting in that, that to view that as a form of progress, because I think back to 2020 and there was the beginning of, I think, that lean in moment where people were felt more comfortable having the questions and it wasn't the dirty topic or a taboo thing to bring up. And I think you're right that there's that continued elevation of, we can at least talk about diversity. We can say it. No one's going to immediately flinch and jump back or any of those things. Like, this is a conversation we can at least have. We're not going to solve it. And it may not be the most pleasant conversation, but at least we're at the point where it's a regular conversation. It's not taboo. And it's always sort of on the table of, we can talk about this now. So I think it's an interesting way of looking at like the progress is, it is a conversation.
But let me address what you just shared. Another place where we've made progress is the performative initiatives. It was very hot and happening. The reason we know that they're performative is because they were part of the budget that is now being cut. And that programming is now out. Conversely, the budget that included this work, initiatives will continue. The work, the programming, the strategy help, everything will continue. A lot of progress on performative statements. Here's the other thing. I think it's pretty loud right now. It's going to get louder and louder. Our young people, our robust, assertive, very clear young people.
Yeah.
They ain't taking no.
Yes, sir. Yes, you can. Yes.
Yes, we'll help you build your analysis. Yes, we'll help you build your strategy if you don't have one. And we'll give it time and thoughtfulness. But just know that that's not the end. Because the next thing is to prep your organization for who's coming in. You might have the best hiring and recruiting strategy, but I wouldn't be surprised if a lack of retention starts becoming a market theme in the next decade, because people aren't staying. There is too much of an entrepreneurial spirit out there people are not going to stay. And as we know, everyone has a voice. Everyone mm-hmm. with any kind of platform has a voice. Your young people, the folk coming in, are going to ask more of you.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be ready for that moment. You know, we've been working with Farsight for 2 years and we've come all this way. They're going to say not good enough.
How do we do that? How does a business, and I like what you said, that where we're going is a place that we've never been before. How do we prep for that? How do we tell businesses, or what we should be saying to them, to the idea of what's coming next you cannot prepare for, but you yet still need to prepare for?
Listen, I was telling you that we're in the middle of a couple of assessments with two mm-hmm. of our clients. In another one of them, a theme that is recurring right now is a lack of respect for the young folk coming on. And that has affected their retention. It's like a clear gap. Accept that they're going to come in stronger, hotter than you ever did. They're just they're fearless in a beautiful way. Have no problem speaking truth to power. Invest in those voices, listen to those voices, co-create with those voices. But if you continue to keep them on the other side of the table, and us and them, that is going to hurt you in the long run. It might not hurt you currently, but it will hurt you in the long run, because they are the future. They are the future executives of your company. You might not even recognize what that company looks like when they are up there.
And to an extent, though, isn't that the whole purpose of the of EDIA and all the work that's being done, is to eliminate the gap between the us and them? Whether it's we're talking about race, whether we're talking about disability, gender, and I think specifically at this point, you know, that's the answer there, is that we've always sort of looked at, you know, ageism as the older population being the ones who are sort of being left out. But if our future is this younger population, that gap needs to be closed immediately as well. Like, they need to be all in on the process of planning the future, because they're not planning your future, they're planning their future.
You bring up a really good point that I was reminded of by a client of mine. From her perspective, it was so powerful. It really moved me. She was like, you know, there is so much focus on the young generation. Like, we got to listen to them and they are our future. She's having a very hard time because she is now in the space of experiencing the ageism. And she was like, I feel accused when I don't get it. There is no investment of time. And I was like, oh my God, that is such a huge point of how do we bring the other side along at whatever speed that they're at? Because this cannot be an either or. This cannot be the binary of you're either in and you get it, or you're out and you don't. We have to hold ourselves to the nuance and complexity that all of this work surfaces. I want to highlight what you just said, that is really important, the ageism factor. There's a whole other, you know, neurodiversity. The new workforce is going to be the highest representation of a neurodiverse population than we've ever had. That's not to say that previous generations have not been neurodiverse. We just didn't have that vocabulary or diagnosis.
Exactly.
And that is going to be, you know, you mentioned disability, right? Disability, neurodiversity has been the other. It has been the minority. Neurodiversity is going to be like, how many of us are wearing glasses these days? It's in the majority. It's going to be the new normal. And so the other space for organizations to get ready is understand access needs, understand accommodations. Don't wait for someone who is dyslexic or ADHD to figure out, okay, how are we going to support them? Already have that in place so that your company becomes a viable option for them.
Yeah.
Like exactly. I tell folk who are still resistant to pronouns, if you do not have your pronouns in your signature, that is telling a message to someone who identifies outside of the binary. And it's not just an optics thing. It's not just a performative thing. It's like these moments, get ready, prepare yourself, clean house, you know, like whatever analogies work, so that your place becomes a viable option for someone. You know, there's ADHD, there's dyslexia, that folk who are hearing impaired, visually impaired, don't wait for them to come through and then be like, oh my God, I'm having this challenge. No, have your software in place, have, you know, your HR and CDO involved, have those conversations, start making access needs something that is already being done at the organization, that accommodations are already being offered for whoever might avail of it, so that when someone else comes, someone with that identity comes through, it's like, oh, this is just their way of working here.
Yeah.
And it's,
I like that.
Let's say I have an invisible disability, right? And I have shared that in my interview process, and I'm being hired to tick off your diversity checkbox. And suddenly you and your team are doing all of this work to make me feel welcomed and tell us what you need, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, oh, I thought you already would know what I need.
That's so interesting. One of the presentations that I give, there's a clip that I show from a presenter who speaks to that exact notion of, if the first time a new hire hears about your DEI efforts is 3 months after they've been hired, you're failing at DEI. Because you don't have efforts. It needs to be so embedded that when I apply, I already know about your DEI efforts. If I'm hired, I'm working, I've got a desk, and then all of a sudden I'm hearing about DEI, you failed already. Because it's not a part of the process, it's an afterthought. And so I think going to what you said, that idea of build that future company. Like if you may not have the ADA accessible person today, but they're never going to apply, because you don't have access now. So build access, and then you're inclusive from the get-go. It's not only you're inclusive, you've got a welcome sign up saying that we're welcoming you. We don't need to do the back-end work to build for you. We've already built. You're welcome here.
Yes. Same thing with mental health. Mm-hmm. Resources, support, space, time off, vacation, whatever that is, all of that needs to be reassessed right now.
Yeah.
Also, how do you define mental health needs to be discussed within every organization, because right now this term is just being, moved around rapidly with a lot of connotations, but define it for yourselves and then create support and resources for that. Working mothers, a working parent, not just working mothers, but working parents, single parents. That is only going to continue increasing. I think the biggest thing looking ahead is prepare for more intersectional conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Because that's what you're going to get. You're going to get an intersectional identity. You're not just going to get an Asian woman or a Black man or, a Muslim woman. No, you will get a potentially mixed race, non-binary, visually disabled person. Right.
And making sure that at all levels, that person is included and feels welcomed.
Yeah. And so all the more reason, this is timely stuff. The sooner you have the capacity, have your race analysis, have your gender analysis in place, have your disability education and analysis in place. Because if you don't have that, it's going to be harder for you. You have to understand the Black experience and the trans experience to then have your analysis of the Black trans experience.
All of the siloed efforts of understanding identity will need to go away, because identity will no longer be looked at as siloed as we become more inclusive and more understanding of those around us.
I just don't think they're going to be in the forefront. Have the binary, you might still have, but it's... intersectional identities are the future.
And I think when you put in disability and mental health and all of these things, and we really start fully understanding people at a holistic level, I think intersectionality there's no way it's not the future, because no one person is just one thing.
If all of this is what you have to prepare for, the other thing you have to prepare for is reassessing performance metrics. Because learning disabilities, visible and invisible disabilities, all of this identity work, how are you doing your performance reviews? What are your measurements? And because if you do all of this welcoming stuff, once you start shifting one thing, you better shift everything else that relates to that one thing.
Yeah.
If not, here's what's going to happen. You're going to be super welcoming to this intersectional identity. They're going to come in. They're going to feel great about it. Great. You checked off hiring. You checked off recruiting. You did a great job. 1 year in, they're in their performance review, and those metrics and those measurements have not been changed. Now they are being assessed through the lens of identities that is not theirs.
Once you start, it's everything has to change. Everything has to shift.
Everything has to shift.
Yeah. Well, Well, Farah, I want to thank you for your time today. Is there one last thought or one last thing to leave listeners with, or potential business leaders who may be listening, just one last thing if nothing else they take away from this conversation?
I hope this was not an overwhelming conversation. I know we were talking a lot of high-level stuff. For me, the work is about, let's get really concrete, right? Mm-hmm. Pick one space. Like, whoever is listening in, what's within your sphere of influence? You could influence a feedback conversation next week. And maybe something that you took away from here can influence that. You could influence an assessment that you're about to put out there and maybe slow down and re-engage a conversation. Stay in your sphere of control, because not everything is going to be in your control. Influence that. Build your advocacy. Build your analysis. Stay learning. Continue being a student. I say that because I do that myself as well. Keep space for reflection. Gather feedback. Reassess. And keep that cycle going. One of the things with Farsight, we have a fierce lens to accountability for ourselves and our clients. And our call to action is what I want to leave you with. Do more, do it better, and do it different. It's not in the thinking about it, it's in the doing. So go ahead and do more, do better, and do it different.
Farah, thank you so much for your time today. This has been amazing. If folks wanted to get a hold of you, what would be the easiest way?
So you can email me. It's farah@gofarsight.com. I would love to hear from you, especially if you've listened to this episode and your thoughts. Our website, gofarsight.com. We also have our this incredible resource of our video podcast that we started in 2020 called Farsight Friday, because it ties into the learning element that I'm talking about, right? We are constantly churning up episodes, bringing in thought leaders around very specific topics. So we did one on neurodiversity. We did one on the HR-EDIA relationship. We did one on global EDIA for our global clients. And what we're trying to do with these curated conversations is really take a topic that is and really tussle with it, right? We're not here to solve any problems, but we're really here to, like, let's unpack it. What does this involve? What does it take? What are the nuances to consider? What are we not considering? There are free episodes to take a listen. You could just have them on and as you potter around your day. But there is so much learning that you can get from those. Something that I'm very proud of, and it just happened very organically in 2020. And hopefully we get Dan to join us next year.
We'll definitely
learn. Continue your learning journey.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Farah Bala from GoFarsight.com. That's GoFarsight.com. Make sure you check out the website. And again, I will put the email address and the website in the show notes. So Farah, again, thank you very, very much for your time today.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you for what you do, and thank you to your listeners. It takes everyone to do this.